Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1 with Opel and the all-new Opel Crossland. Beauty isn't scared of life.
Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.
And we're joined now by consultant obstetrician and gynaecologist at Murray and Fertility Clinic and Hollis Street, Dr. Cathy Allen, and also GP Dr. Amy Morgan to discuss fertility. So as I said, if you have any questions, do get them in to us. 51551 is the number. We have lots to get through. And I want to start, if we can, with polycystic ovarian syndrome. Dr. Allen, I might start with you. Good morning to you both, first of all. Can you tell me a little bit about PCOS, as it's known, polycystic ovarian syndrome? And how it can impact fertility?
So good morning, Claire. Polycystic ovarian syndrome, I suppose the key thing to understand is it can affect different people in many different ways. And it's quite a spectrum of the disease. The spectrum can range from very little, very mild outward physical clues all the way to having something very obvious and particular characteristic signs and symptoms. So someone will have a very slim physique and a regular menstrual cycle, normal fertility, and are just found incidentally to have features of the condition, for example, if they're having a pelvic ultrasound scan or a blood test or something else, whereas others can present with significant difficulty, say, with weight control, acne, hirsutism, which is facial hair, and, say, menstrual problems such as infrequent or very heavy periods. Now, the latter menstrual problems would suggest defects in ovulation. So infertility is quite common in this group. And ovulatory defects like that can be corrected with certain interventions, sometimes weight reduction or medications or a surgical procedure. And then, of course, advanced reproductive technologies like IVF are there as well. There is a kind of a metabolic sometimes component to polycystic ovarian syndrome. So there's a higher risk of diabetes. And in addition to these differing ways that it can present, it can manifest and become apparent at different times of life. So some women will only discover that they have infrequent or lack of menstrual cycles when, say, they discontinue the oral contraceptive pill, whereas others may have a very long history of menstrual irregularity. So I suppose it's not one size fits all, and every individual case is assessed for the many different ways it can happen.
And Amy, Dr. Morgan, is diet important? We heard Dr. Allen there talking about some people having weight issues when it comes to PCOS. So is diet important when you're looking at controlling this?
Good morning, Claire. Yeah, it is actually. And I think the important point to that we take from this is that we're not fully sure what causes polycystic ovarian syndrome, but there are certainly hormonal links, and essentially that is the underlying component here in terms of the imbalance of the hormones and the excess of what we call these circulating kind of male hormones or the androgens. And there is a link to insulin and how the body responds to insulin. And you know, I think some people will be familiar, insulin regulates glucose regulation in the body. So it does appear that there's some mechanism at play here in terms of women who suffer from PCOS, who have a dysregulation of insulin and how the body responds. And we do know that the evidence is strongly there to support that changes in terms of weight and actually really, I suppose, exercise will actually improve a woman's response in terms of her overall level of the disease itself. I mean, it's actually one of the first line treatments. If we have diagnosed PCOS in a woman, irrespective of whether she is concerned about fertility or not, but if she wants to manage her symptoms, certainly we would be looking at her lifestyle. And if she doesn't have a high level of activity or exercise, that's certainly something that we would be recommending and crucially, obviously, maintaining a healthy body weight.
Okay. And can it wax and wane?
Yes, it can. I suppose with everything, you know, over time and over the course of time as well, I think there was an important point made there by Dr. Allen in terms of how, when this presents. So sometimes actually in my practice, I would actually pick up people in their early 20s who may have had symptoms from their early teens, but may have had their symptoms masked by being on something like the contraceptive pill. And then when they come off, they really can see that their cycles are irregular, because we know obviously one of the symptoms here is that because of the dysregulation of the hormones, we're not getting a regular cycle in a lot of women who suffer from PCOS. And it can fluctuate over the course of a woman's natural reproductive age. So yeah, it is important to be very aware of the symptoms. And then obviously as well, if you're planning to have a family, it's important to know what your cycle is like and consider the possibility of something like PCOS, because it's actually quite common. And it's important to say that not everyone who's PCOS will have difficulties conceiving. Not everyone who has PCOS will have multiple ovarian cysts. You know, the symptoms can vary from person to person, as Dr. Allen said.
Okay. Kathy, here's a question for you. I had very bad endometriosis that was caused by cornuate uterus. I hope I'm saying that properly. This was operated on 6 years ago. I no longer suffer the terrible pain that I did. I'm 32 and I'm trying to get pregnant. But because of my past, would you advise going to my GP if getting pregnant doesn't happen after 6 months? On a side note, I wanted to send love to women suffering with endometriosis. It's a really painful disorder.
Oh, that's a nice bit of collegiality there and solidarity, because yes, it is a very distressing condition. I would agree with that caller, that she should see her GP. There is a significant history there, and it would be very wise to check in with her GP soon. This could facilitate some baseline investigations over the coming months, so that if needed, a referral on to a fertility service could be done in a timely fashion if indeed a pregnancy doesn't occur in the interim. Bicornuate uterus and endometriosis aren't necessarily go together. You know, bicornuate uterus just means there are two cornua, or two sort of sides to the uterus, and it's kind of not the kind of pear-shaped organ, but has a slight indentation in the top of it. So there's nothing wrong with that. Many people will have some variation of an unusual shape to their uterus, which may never cause them any problems with either fertility or having a baby. But it may have been something that was picked up on, say, ultrasound scanning. The prognosis, I would really hope, in such a young person should be good, but definitely don't leave it more than 6 months of trying to conceive. Okay. Without moving on.
Especially with that history. And Amy, this one is for you. In the past few years, I've been running long distance, marathons, half marathons, etc. At times, this affects my cycle and I miss periods. Should I cut back on intense exercise now that I'm trying to conceive?
Menstrual cycles and periods are incredibly sensitive to changes in weight, so weight loss and weight gain. So it would be important to know, I suppose, for this particular individual, what their natural healthy weight is, what their BMI is. So obviously, I think a conversation with their GP and maybe checking in with the GP to establish what her normal menstrual cycle is, because that's the key to knowing, I suppose, you know, obviously how well you're ovulating. And if you know how well you're ovulating, we can kind of make a plan in terms of, you know, whether this lady would need onwards referral or not. I think, you know, activities such as long distance running while exercise is really, really important, as we touched on before, in terms of improving your chances of becoming pregnant and sustaining a healthy pregnancy. You know, the body is very, very good, unfortunately, sometimes at responding to severe stress and changes in your weight. And it can take a while sometimes for that change to actually reverse itself. So I think if it's something that she's noticed herself and it's a direct correlation or connection in terms of the level of activity she's doing, it may be a factor, and she should probably consider speaking to her GP about just getting a general health checkup and seeing what her I suppose her BMI levels have been like over the last couple of months in relation to that exercise.
And Kathy, this one is for you. So we have a couple here, a woman who's 37, the partner's 35. They've been trying to conceive for a year in March. They got fertility tested in September. The partner is all clear with the sperm quality, but the woman in this couple has a low AMH level for my age, approximately 1 ng per milliliter. Is IVF the only option? Temps every month confirm ovulation, should I get progesterone checked?
Okay, so they've obviously been very proactive about getting things checked, which is super. That's can be all that's needed sometimes. AMH stands for anti-Müllerian hormone, and it's a hormone that the ovaries secrete directly, so it comes directly from that ovary. It is associated with the number of eggs, so the quantity of eggs remaining in what is a finite egg bank. All women get their eggs when they're a fetus in their own mother's uterus, and the complement then decreases over time. AMH just reflects where that is. So it certainly does look low there for that lady, but it's important to know that AMH on its own, the absolute value, is not a predictor of pregnancy. It is a predictor of how well one might respond to stimulating drugs that are used in fertility treatment. So many people who have a low AMH can still conceive and never knew they had an AMH that was low. However, in the context of a couple who have delay in conceiving, it does become more important because we're now planning ahead. And if you don't want the AMH to drop anymore, if he happens to be, just have that in her biological fate. So it would be definitely advisable to go and speak to GP and maybe move on with assisted reproduction, given that her age is over 36, because quality of eggs will also decline as well as quantity. But listen, it's really important that a full profile of investigations, including, say, tubal fallopian tubes, patency testing, a scan is done. And there is another way of looking at ovarian reserve with an ultrasound called an antral follicle count. So that may give a similar or slightly better picture. If the cycle is regular, she's probably ovulating, and the basal body temperatures are reassuring. Ovulation prediction kits can sometimes give further reassurance and are easy to self-arrange. But there's probably little to gain by doing more tests of ovulation at this stage, as either way, it's time to take it up a notch and see your GP.
So we have another one, and this one is from a man here, Cathy, for you again. A man in his late 20s. As a teenager, I needed treatment that could affect my fertility, so I was offered the chance to freeze a sperm sample for future IVF use. I later found out that I was indeed sterile as a result of the treatment, and now I wonder how likely it is that the sample I gave as a teenager will be successful in a future attempt of IVF, or should I assume it's an outside chance?
Well, first of all, fair play to that man. It is fantastic that he took the opportunity to freeze sperm before what was his life-saving therapy. And having this in storage really does offer him a realistic chance for fatherhood. Now, the lab who froze the sperm will have details on the semen parameters at the time of freezing. And they might even have details on the results of a post-thaw sample of that sperm. The good news is that because of low water content inside sperm, they tend to freeze and thaw very well. There's no ice crystal formation inside. And the duration of time in cryo storage doesn't seem to have much effect on the overall quality of the sample. Now, even if the sperm count or motility was low, if he was unwell at the time of freezing that sample, it's more than an outside chance for pregnancy, especially if the female partner is a similarly young age. So overall, I would be optimistic, but I would get more specific details from the unit he attended in his earlier years.
Amy, this one for you, because I think you'd be the first port of call here as a GP. Can my vasectomy of 20 years ago be reversed?
Well, good question. it is, I suppose, vasectomy actually is very much underrepresented in terms of the chat we would have with patients about family planning. It's amazing. You'll have women come in and they've gone to the, you know, they've completed their family and they've gone through all the options. And vasectomy is just not something that has come forward onto the table. So, but, you know, we are seeing it more in terms of patients being proactive and wanting to support their partners. And vasectomy actually, you know, there isn't a lot of awareness about it. And I think that, you know, it feeds into sort of scenarios like this because, you know, people just actually don't know what the situation is. It is certainly a procedure that is done actually by some GPs themselves, but you have to have a special interest in it, or some women and their partners will go obviously to specialised clinics to have it done. It is not advertised as what we call a reversible form of contraception. So there are obviously lots of reversible forms of contraception, and obviously they're primarily aimed at at the woman here. So, but you will encounter situations where, you know, people's life circumstances change and they're in another relationship down the road, and it's something that they want to reconsider. So I think theoretically it is possible, but they would obviously need to have a conversation with their GP, and they would need to then be referred on to a specialist who works in this area to discuss their further management options. Yeah.
And then another one, Amy, that you might address for us is this one. My husband is on antidepressants for the last year. Would he have to come off these in order for them to conceive?
The simple answer is no. But obviously, I think it's certainly worth having the conversation, because there's a few factors at play. Certainly when it comes to male fertility, there are absolute some definite drugs that we do know that will affect a man's fertility. So he may be on medical treatment, immunosuppressant medication, having radiotherapy, etc. Or, you know, sometimes over the counter drugs like anti-inflammatories, or, you know, unfortunately, some people who use steroids in terms of anabolic steroids, for example, and they can be directly implicated in reducing a man's fertility. But antidepressants, no, there is no evidence to support that they will. And I also think it's really important that, you know, if this is something that a man needs to be on, mental health is really important for a couple and for an individual who are trying for a family. And it can be a stressful time for people. So, you know, it may not be appropriate that he considers coming off, but again, having the conversation with your GP, seeing where you're at. But I would reassure them that no, if they're trying, and it's a medication that he feels that he needs, in tandem, you know, with a conversation with his clinician, that, you know, that there's no need for him to come off it.
And Cathy, this is another one about the man in the relationship. My partner has just been diagnosed with a rare myeloid neoplasm and is starting chemo drugs. Should we freeze his sperm before the treatment starts? Age is not on our side. He's 40, I'm 43. We've been trying naturally for a few years. And then the question ends, or should we just give up?
Oh, goodness. Well, the most important focus here is your partner's health and the optimization of his future and get on with his life-saving therapy. Remember, not all chemotherapy is toxic to fertility, and many modern regimens are actually quite fertility-sparing. But his oncologist will be the best place to advise on this. So if there's time, and if he's well enough, he could attend the clinic for sperm freezing. This could be done really rapidly, you know, in a matter of days. So it shouldn't start the delay of any chemo. The oncology team can even arrange the necessary referral pathway and get viral screens done at their own hospital. So the patient can then be offered a good rapid appointment at a nearby fertility clinic. There is actually government funding for this service, so cost should not be an issue. On the other hand, if he's unwell, if he's generally unwell at the moment, lack of energy and weight loss, you know, the prospect of freezing sperm and fertility concerns may be just an added stressor for him, and also for the lady involved here. If he happens to be rendered infertile by successful chemotherapy, then you know what, there will be other options down the line, like donor sperm, to consider. The fact here that the female is now 43 years of age and they've been trying to conceive for a long time is another matter. So it's definitely worth having a fertility consultation. But depending on circumstances, once he's well, you could try for pregnancy using either fresh sperm if it's still available, or frozen sperm if it's frozen in advance. And then the decision will be whether to use your own eggs or use donated eggs, but all of this after appropriate counselling. But again, just to say that the primary focus here is health and survival, and I really wish them best wishes for swift recovery there.
Now, Amy, I'm 34 and breastfeeding my first child, says this listener, who's 17 months old. My period has not yet returned. I would like to have a second child, but I'd also like to continue breastfeeding. I'd love any advice as to how I might improve my chances of conceiving.
So I think first thing to say, she's doing amazing. So obviously, in terms of the benefits that she's getting from breastfeeding and the benefits that her baby is getting, it's obviously multifold. So I suppose there's no definite, you know, defined time frame that she should stop if she feels it's something that suits her and her baby, and you know, they're getting that bonding effect. And obviously, you know, there's lots, you know, to be explored within that, you know, in terms of, you know, are there factors in terms of her going back to work and logistics around breastfeeding, and then what is her ultimate time frame in terms of wanting to progress forward in terms of expanding her family. So I think in terms of the breastfeeding itself, you know, when you do breastfeed exclusively, it can be used actually as a contraceptive method. I suppose we wouldn't be over reliant on it. It's called the lactational amenorrheic method. But you can technically still have a period during this time frame, and obviously if you're having a period, you're ovulating, so you can conceive. I suppose what's difficult for this woman is that she's not having a period at all. And that could be really just solely down to the fact that she is breastfeeding exclusively. But obviously it makes it difficult for her to predict where her current fertility patterns lie. There's nothing to suggest in her history that she has any difficulty in terms of fertility. She's conceived without any issues, and she's happy, and she's 34, and she's obviously healthy. So I suppose, you know, it may be just something that happens naturally over time, and she may be willing to give it some time. So I suppose if baby is gradually feeding less, you know, in terms of reduced night feeds, it may be that naturally her periods will return anyway. But it can be hard to judge. So I suppose having a conversation again, I know I keep coming back to it, but having a conversation with her GP just to make sure there wasn't any pre-existing issues in terms of her overall menstrual cycle, her fertility patterns, and then obviously seeing what happens in terms of her actual when her periods come back, because that's going to be the best predictor for her to know in terms of where her fertility is currently at.
Okay, so no major concerns, but it might be worth a chat with the GP on that.
Absolutely.
One.
Absolutely, yeah.
So Cathy, we have one here. I really feel sorry for this person, because I just having this worry, I would like to ask what effect an eating disorder in the late teens and early 20s may have on future fertility. And you can imagine what's going through that person's mind there. But what's the advice on that? Does it have an impact?
So it's complex. You know, eating disorders are quite a spectrum in there. But essentially, it shouldn't negatively impact one's fertility in the future. If it was a very serious problem and weight was really too low for a long time, there can be impacts, say, on bone health. So, you know, you can get a little bit of brittle bone disease if somebody has low estrogen levels from not ovulating and having a period for a long time. So actually the pregnancy might be a concern. But actually, no, the eating disorder should not. Now, there's so much to it. It's not just a physical considerations. There are psychological considerations. And I have found when I have looked after patients who have that in their history, the vast majority do very well and don't necessarily have a problem. But if some are facing fertility challenges, actually the idea of putting on weight at that time in order to go to therapy or indeed in a pregnancy can be really something that is to be overcome ahead of therapy. So, but if it is well and truly managed well and that patient is over it, it is back to, you know, the basics, the brute biology that affects everybody else.
Michael is very brave now asking this question. What's the max age for a woman to have a child? Amy, dare you answer that question?
No.
I suppose look, the question is, like, at what age a woman comes into you and they're pregnant at 46, 47. Are
yes.
you worried then at that point for that person and for the baby?
No, I'm not. I think we have to, while age, you know, can be certainly a dominant strand in the discussion around fertility, like I said in our previous discussion, sometimes it gets overly aimed at the woman, and she can be extraordinarily self-conscious about it. And it comes up in my consultations again and again, you know, am I too old? Should I be trying? You know, and it really depends on the person and their individual level of health. You know, you might have someone in their 20s who actually, for a variety of reasons, has not enjoyed good health. They may not enjoy good lifestyle habits. You know, they may smoke, and, you know, they may have issues, you know, in terms of other issues. And they may not actually be textbook healthy. And then you will see someone who is in their mid-40s and they're perfectly healthy and they've had previous pregnancies and they're absolutely fine and this is something that they want to do. And I think once they're supported in their journey and, you know, they are monitored during their pregnancy, that there's no real reason, I suppose, why, you know, we should have an hour. And I think we need to move away from arbitrary cutoffs. I mean,
yes,
certainly,
the dates, yeah.
I think, it's obviously important for GPs and obstetricians and gynecologists to be mindful of these things, and particularly when we're having the conversation about chances of fertility, chance of conception, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, not putting things off too long. But at the same time, you know, again, it would all depend on the person. And I think that gentleman probably okay. needs to have a think about what is the figure in his mind that he feels is acceptable for
Listen,
him.
Listen, we've got to leave it there. But thank you both so much. A huge response again to Dr. Cathy Allen and Dr. Amy Morgan.